There's something about that lonesome whistle-blowing, that high wailing sound, the sheer bulk of the thing that causes a person to ponder. The great ponderer himself, Henry David Thoreau, felt a kind of ambivalence about the train, saying, in one part of Walden, "The whistle of the locomotive penetrates my woods summer and winter, sounding like the scream of a hawk." And, "When I hear the iron horse makes the hills echo with his snort like thunder, shaking the earth with his feet, and breathing fire and smoke from his nostrils, it seems as if the earth had got a race now worthy to inhabit it." But earlier still, with his more typical suspicion concerning the technology of his day, he discoursed in an even more negative manner. "If we do not get out sleepers, and forge rails, and devote days and nights to the work, but go to tinkering upon our lives to improve them, who will build railroads? And if railroads are not built, how shall we get to heaven in season? But if we stay at home, mind our business, who will want railroads? We do not ride on the railroad. It rides upon us." Today, we board the train together, throttle up, go along for the ride, sit at sidings, watch the scenery, as Mind's Eye radio writers take you on trains of thought and rail tales. Madison writer Jeff Black reflects on the love and fear of trains and tracks in his piece, Railroaded.
"I ponder my fascination of trains. I love the sounds. I'm in an odd way, frightened by their sight. Such strength within them, the intermediate between horses and cars. Some of my fear comes from a dream I've had too many times to count, where I'm in my truck, the first in line at a railroad crossing, a line of cars behind me, and the train starts coming off its tracks, and I'm stuck. I can't back up to get away fast enough, and I, most of the time in this dream, end up getting out of the truck or car, running like hell to get away from the thundering sound of steel on steel, rails splitting, sparks and fire. When I cannot successfully get out of the truck, I wake right out of this dream with heartbeat full speed. Fear, out of respect for their power. I think of all the tracks I've somehow ended up living within 100 yards from. I live 70 yards from a set of busy railroad tracks now, and I've still not seen one wreck with my own eyes. At least if I ever am at that railroad crossing, and that steel monster does come off the track, which is always a possible occurrence, I will now know exactly what to do to keep from being crushed like a bug in its metal wake. Just as a brand new black hardcover writing book gives me the sensation of excitement offered only by an open road and a full tank of gas, trains give me a subdivision of feeling of travel. It's odd to think that the only trains I've ever ridden on was the Chicago L and amusement park trains. I've never been on a real train. I hope someday to ride or maybe drive a freight train, to see what it looks like and to feel the sensation of the open rails and side sights zipping by. To view that dreamy railroad crossing from the powerful train's point of view instead of the nearly helpless waiter's delay at the crossing gate. Most of all, I like the sounds of trains. The sounds soothe me and take me back 100 or more years, to a time of less convenience and obnoxious greed.
think of being 14 years old, maybe 15, and the railroad tie fort me and some friends built, and how it was built too close to the railroad tracks to be legal or allowed. The railroad company brought a big pickup truck out to the fort to pull it down, but they couldn't. To our amusement and pride, they had to tie the rope to a small freighter to bring our fort to its demise. To be there at that fort after dark, drinking whatever booze we could scam, 25 yards from the tracks with the blaring steel wheels and the shaking of the solid ground, we laughing our sides in and the rush of it all, that still holds as one of my fondest memories of trains and tracks. Or the bridge on Monon Road in Shelby, Indiana, hanging over the irrigation canal from the undersiding of the train bridge frame, the waiting and progressive rumble, the multiplying vibrations of steel that our hands and feet clung to over the water, then the slam of the engine cars to the ears, eyes, nerves, and hair follicles, hanging on with all might as tons of screaming steel rush by, 2.5 feet above your face.
That and other essays are found on Jeff Black's spoken word collection, Stand the Stars.
Swing that hammer. Swing that hammer. Swing it higher of your head. Making little ones out of big ones. I'ma kill you almost dead.
Sometimes one has to accidentally bump up against experience in order to appreciate the lesson to be learned. Writer Fran Rawl recalls a chance to look at life from another perspective on a train that rounds an unexpected bend in her young life.
All aboard! I have always liked train travel, especially when I could spend the night sleeping on one. I feel rocked back and forth, speeding through the night, imagining the scenery, and knowing that if I were awake, I wouldn't see it anyway. In Europe, my pleasure in this was rather spoiled by the fact that they woke you up any old time for passport checks. In 1967, our family of four took the famous Super Chief train to California. This was one of the last runs for this historic train, the route for movie stars and important people reaching for the Golden West. At that time, I didn't know all the history of Indian crafts, which were embellished and promoted by Fred Harvey along that route paralleled by US 66 from Chicago to LA. We were in comfortable compartments, no climbing into an upper berth, or trips to the washroom made famous by Agatha Christie in Murder on the Orient Express. But I think my most memorable train trip was when the two girls and I embarked in Houston in 1962 to travel to my sister in Palm Springs, California. We entered a train on which we were a minority, a curiosity, except no one was curious, no other white faces. Fresh from the South, where blacks cultivated a hearty greeting, I started smiling at people. No one smiled back. At that moment, I started to realize that smiling and talking friendly were a black survival method woven into the Southern culture. Back to the train of reality. One woman asked the girls to sit with her, but it wasn't long till my oldest came back and said they wanted to come back to me. Rescued, she told me about being bombarded with religious doctrine. So we read and watched scenery until mealtime. We sat opposite a black couple who acted like they were alone. Usually at meals you greet your table mates, which I did. The woman nodded sparely, but the man gave us a basilisk look. After the meal, he sat picking his teeth. The only response I got on that whole trip was joking in the washroom with three young women. I didn't get upset by this situation. I figured it served white folks right to be on the other side. No, not really on the other side. In the olden days, intruding into forbidden ground would have been dangerous. As things slowly changed, Rosa Parks was not shoved or hit. As far as we know, she was just arrested when she refused to give up her seat on the bus. We didn't undergo any of this. We just weren't there. I think it was one of the most interesting experiences I ever had. A fitting end to this rather unreal trip was to be put off the train onto a platform in a wilderness so little developed that I spent a few minutes wondering what we would do if my sister had some trouble and couldn't come to get us. Palm Springs evidently didn't want any nasty, noisy, smelly train depot right in their town. This is Fran Wall highballing for Mind's Eye Radio.
One thing the train is good for is moving mass amounts of anything, long distances in the shortest, flattest, and what used to be the quickest possible way. Having observed that fact, and having also observed that waves of immigrants were causing horrific social problems in the big cities of the East, a minister named Charles Loring Brace hit upon an idea to bring the two observations together. He developed an adoption program, which, while crude and cruel by our modern standards, was widely seen as a pragmatic example of Yankee ingenuity during his time. Thus were born the orphan trains.
Their names were Anna and Emil, Isabel, Bessie, and Lee. Hundreds of Catherines and Roses and Patricks, ranging in ages from a few months to 15 years. They all rode the trains, the so-called orphan trains, almost all of them abandoned or orphaned or sometimes just temporarily uncared for. Nearly all came from orphanages in the East, such as the Children's Aid Society, a New York City orphanage, but the New York Foundling Hospital sent children as well. Before this method of finding homes fell into disfavor, Boston, Chicago, and Philadelphia agencies had put children aboard the trains, too. Sometimes there were surviving parents who were forced by destitution to give up just one or sometimes two children of families of five or more. Sometimes the children's parents sent along a memento, a pink envelope containing the boy's history, a special piece of clothing. More than 200,000 waifs, at the mercy of whomever chose them, standing like calves at auction at railroad stations and churches throughout 47 of the United States, largely in the Midwest and South and West. If you were a baby, one writer told me, the chances are the family adopting you really wanted a child instead of a servant. But if you were older, then God help you. Nobody could tell what they wanted you for. Sometimes, children headed for one destination ended up elsewhere as well. In 1902, when 35 adoptable children were offered to the citizenry of Bayfield, Wisconsin by Catholic nuns, not a single white family came forward to adopt any child, according to Linda Bristol, a genealogist specializing in the Chippewa tribal history. But when Chippewa families of the Red Cliff and Bayfield areas stepped forward and gave homes to 30 of the children, with one family taking four children into their home, some of the local white folks were outraged and felt that the children should not have been given, as they said, to the savages. One of the children, incidentally, Matilda Talbot, is listed as being of Negro blood. 200,000 kids, destined to be unpaid farm workers and chambermaids, but also governors and nurses and bus drivers and lawyers. Between 1854 and 1929, all of these children, sometimes immigrant Irish and Slavic, nearly all white and all poor, were placed out in the largest movement of its type in American history. According to the Children's Aid Society report, by 1910, Wisconsin had taken in 2,750 such children. How many more came by the time the last train rolled is as unknown as their original names.
I was shipped to Minneapolis in a family by the name of Dreis, Frank and Mary Dreis. They took me. They had an older son and daughter, but I was 3 years old when they took me.
Mrs. Anna McCulloch, now a grand and great-grandmother many times over herself, tells her own story from her apartment in Beloit, Wisconsin.
They never legally adopted me, but they gave me their name. I went to school and everything by their name. I went to school by the name of Marion Dreis. And my name was Ann McGinley, originally. And my mother had left me when I was just a few days old. She left me at the New York Foundling Hospital. And I was shipped out with the many 150,000 children that were shipped out from the East, all over the country, while I was sent to Minneapolis. My life was not too bad. The dad and I got along wonderful, but then after he died, Mother and I didn't get along quite so well. She told the social worker, who came every year, that I wasn't doing things just the way I should. So the social worker had told her that, well, if that was the case, they'd send me back. Well, tell a 15-year-old that they got a chance to go to New York. What do? Everything they can to go to New York.
Though life on her own was thrilling for Anna, she eventually returned to the only home she had known, but did not find it welcoming.
They told me that I wasn't their child, and I resented it very much. Other children knew, you know, from the same parish, they knew that I wasn't their legal child. So I'd fought, and I resented it very much when they told me that I wasn't their child.
And the children searched and wondered. One writer told me that while he and his brother were placed only miles apart on farms in Oklahoma, they saw each other only twice while growing up. Without transportation, and given the heavy work most of the orphans faced, 10 miles was the same as 100.
Yeah, I'm supposed to have had a brother. Never was able to find out anything about him. He was supposed to have been adopted. And I don't know, I haven't been able to find out nothing. I've tried, but I didn't have any money and didn't have the time.
At reunions in Iowa, Arkansas, Illinois, Minnesota, they search still. Tears flow freely and unashamedly as grandmothers and grandfathers tell and retell what they know of their personal histories. They network and search for that one brother, that lost father. The last writers are growing old. A baby placed aboard the last train would now be 70 years old. This is the last generation left to tell the first person's story. They called us train kids and warned us not to speak, says Sylvia Wimhoff, an 80-year-old grandmother. But now, whenever we see each other, we can't stop talking.
Seven children, same suitcase in hand, waited on the platform. We tried to understand why the train was taking us to towns we didn't know. Hell's Kitchen's kids in brand new clothes, some stranger take us home.
Music in this selection was furnished by Phil Lancaster and Allison Moore. Since this interview was recorded, Mrs. McCulloch, Ann McGinley, has passed away, just as the trains themselves are passing. This is Norma Gay Pruitt, hoping to have helped preserve at least part of Anna's life for all of us and for Mind's Eye Radio.
You're listening to Trains of Thought and Rail Tales on Mind's Eye Radio. We'll be back in a moment. Thank you.
I hear the train coming, it's rolling around the bend, and I ain't seen the sunshine since I don't know when. I'm stuck in Folsom Prison, and time keeps dragging on. But that train keeps rolling on down the San Antonio. When I was just a baby, my mama told me, son, always be a good boy, don't ever play with guns. But I shot a man in Reno just to watch him die. When I hear that whistle blowing, I hang my head and cry. But there's rich folks eating in a fancy dining car. They're probably drinking coffee and smoking big cigars. Well, I know I had it coming, I know I can't be free. But those people keep a moving, and that's what tours. From this prison, if that railroad train was mine, bet I'd move it on a little farther down the line, far from Folsom Prison. That's where I want to stay. And I'd let that lonesome whistle blow my blues away.
We call our free association a train of thought for a reason. In this kind of train, the couplings may be mighty tenuous, but the engine still pulls the whole line. In Train of Thought, Esther Cameron hooks up light-hearted cars to cars that pull a heavy load of painful memories.
There are many things that people have invented that do not turn the muse of poetry on. Take the electric light bulb or the tractor, or the x-ray machine, or the dishwasher, even the automobile, even the airplane. Sure, poems have been written about each of these newfangled things, but the poems seem, is it just me, artificial or prosaic. The invention may be useful, may have made itself ubiquitous and indispensable, but still it's just a thing. It's not a symbol. It doesn't resonate, doesn't strike a chord. Whereas the train has from the first brought out things like Emily Dickinson's ode beginning, "I like to see it lap the miles and lick the valleys up." And where would blues have been without the railroads? "The longest train I ever saw was 17 coaches long. The only gal I ever loved was on that train and gone." Trains kept their hold on our imagination after their usefulness was pretty much over. In 1971, I heard a song by Little Harry with the refrain, "Nobody cares about the railroads anymore." So I am not alone in this perception, though I have special memories of trains. Between the ages of 6 and 11, I lived beside the Illinois Central track that's been torn up now for a bike path. A freight train would come by there twice a day. My brother and I would dash out on the embankment and wave and wave, and if the engineer was looking our way, he'd wave back to us. Naturally, a caboose, with one or two railroad men a-lounge on its back porch, would make our day. Someone told me it wasn't high tone to live beside the railroad tracks, but to us it was royal privilege. So what was it about the railroad train that struck this chord? Well, for a start, It's something that binds the near and far with strings of steel. It brings together and it separates. The coming of the train is regular, timed to circadian rhythms, like, how long has that evening train been gone? The train is long, like a sigh, and has a whistle made, it seems, just to give lonesomeness a voice. And then the fact that if you board a train at A that's scheduled to get in at B, you are committed pretty much to reaching that destination. Once the train pulls out, you can't turn back, you cannot take a detour, you cannot at a crossroads on a whim just take the turn for J or Q instead. So there's this feeling of finality about a train departure, which enhances the symbolism Freud perceives in all departures of the last one. Though if you've been saved, then you can get aboard that gospel train. Then you are bound for glory. You have paid your ticket and don't need to worry. Just don't mention trains in Israel, where every listener, without exception, will flash on cattle cars packed for the death camps. And maybe some of you out there remember from a year or two ago a song I sang. My father was an honest man. He rode the devil's train. That song, written in 1972, reflected my perception that the system my father was a part of and believed in was taking us to some place I, for one, had no desire to visit, far less move to. If you are on a train, it is important to like the place you're headed for. Which brings me by train of thought. Here let me jump the track for just a bit to point out that expression is older than the railroad. The word train comes from the French traîner, meaning to draw or drag. So it applies to any sequence where one thing seems to draw the next, appearing inevitable. Freud somewhere says that free association isn't all that free. So let me, as I said, pick up thought's train from where a previous Mind's Eye radio piece left off, and ride it a bit further. That piece was called Organic Organization. It was a call to organize, this time not just by marching or by writing letters or sending checks, but rather by enlisting in a community of concern where each member's resources and abilities are taken stock of, sorted, matched, deployed, as in a complex, differentiated organism that grows by leaps of faith and by bonds between one person and another. So I'd just like to follow that by saying that the efficiency of such a body would be upgraded if it could adopt certain symbolic forms of interaction, such as the practice of devoting one day of the week to meeting and reflection, keeping the Sabbath, as they used to call it, also some kind of formal architecture linking the cells of members. How exactly such forms would need today to be configured would have to be worked out. I just submit that an organic organization would need to evolve some algorithms, like the rules for sonnets, like the railroad tracks, those lines that started at your feet and sped off toward the horizon, humming even in the quiet, assuring you that there is a way from here to there. I'm Esther Cameron from Mind's Eye Radio.
Trains seem to call for symbolic interpretation, and not always in the Freudian sense, as a character finds in Evie Thompson's story, Switchyard.
A cold northwest wind swept the switchyard beyond the apartment house. It picked up the fine snow that lay between the tracks and sucked the warmth out of the apartment where Elsa sat, staring out the window. They'd turned her down. After 2 years as a special student,
she had been refused entrance to the Master of Fine Arts program. All the money she'd saved from teaching at the high school, plus the money borrowed from her folks, was gone, and she was no further than when she had started. It had been so much fun at first, this change from the bland middle-class life she had been raised in. The ranch-style house, good clothes, two cars, and, oh yes, heat. It had never been cold in her parents' house. She'd been so sure she would prevail in the art world, so sure her talent would be recognized and something glorious lay ahead, that she had pitied her parents for their small lives. She had loved everything about her new life, this apartment, this very poor neighborhood with the men's shelter down the block, the liquor store, tavern, and all-night restaurant, and the almost constant grind and squeal of metal on metal from the trains. And she had loved the smell of turpentine and oil paints, her easel and the feel of the brush moving over the prepared surface of the pressed board. "We're sorry," Professor Smith had said. "The members of the committee have talked it over, and your work is just not good enough. We don't know if you continue to work at it that it will ever be good enough." She had been confused from the very start, not knowing how to pick a committee or a major professor. And, because the college was just beginning its MFA program, the rules seemed to keep changing. At first, they'd recruited students. But in the last 2 years, many more students tried to enter, so the committees could afford to be choosy. Outside her window, a locomotive moved back and forth, collecting cars to make up a train. To one side of the switchyard was a mountain of coal next to the power plant. Beyond the coal was a stack of culverts. Kids once played along the tracks, but the power company had added a chain-link fence when one of the boys was killed climbing on a stack of culverts that came untethered and rolled apart, crushing him. Elsa wondered how the boy felt as the culverts began to roll. Was it anything like what she was feeling? Her life was coming apart. Nothing was solid. She had no place to stand. Elsa remembered the family of the boy, sitting out on their front porch the afternoon of the accident. The father spoke to her as she passed by. He told the story as if he were reporting what he'd read in the newspaper. Just a story. How did people do that? How did they face tragedy with no anguish? She wanted to sit down on the floor, tear her clothes, scream, and bawl. She had failed. She had failed. From outside in the switchyard came the frantic ding, 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 ding of the warning signals at the cross street as the arms barricaded the crossing. With the sound, alarm ran through her body. She wondered how it would feel to be hit by the train. Metal grinding and tearing flesh. It would be a relief. She could almost see the engine looming above her as it approached, the breath going out of her as she leaped into its path. But what if she was just horribly mutilated? And what about her parents? How would they survive such a thing? They had helped by loaning her money, even while warning her against continuing on with grad school. She still remembered her mother, hands twitching nervously, her face tight with anxiety. "It's like expecting to get hit by lightning, Elsa. You're aiming too high." "But, Mom, if you don't reach for the stars, you don't achieve anything at all. This way, even if you fall short, you come up with something." But what had she come up with? Her life was barren. She'd reached a point where she envied others their simpler lives. The bus she rode back and forth to the university passed through a residential section, and at Christmas the windows of the homes were lit up. Families celebrated together. Elsa could see their trees with colored lights and presents under them. And she had been too busy studying for the MFA exam to even put up a tree. In the switchyard below, a section of train approached. A switchman, his scarf standing straight out in the wind, pulled a lever, shifting the rails, and the train turned off to the far track. A knock sounded at the door. Elsa walked over and opened it. "Mom!" "These chrysanthemums were on sale at the discount grocery. I just thought you might like one." She pressed the packaged plant into Elsa's hands. "Mom!"
Elsa choked. Oh, Mom. Her face worked as she fought tears. Swiftly, her mother took the plant from her and set it on the coffee table. She pulled Elsa onto the sofa and put her arms around her. They turned me down, Mom. The committee turned me down. She put her face down on her mother's shoulder, clung to her, and cried out loud. It reminded her of when she was a little girl, and Mom held her on her lap in the old maple rocker. Now, Elsa, engulfed by a kind of comforting misery, wept quietly. Eventually, she noticed that Mom's jacket was getting wet from her tears and pulled back. Mom reached in her purse and pulled out a packet of Kleenex. Elsa blew her nose, wiped her face, and taking a fresh Kleenex, dabbed at Mom's jacket. You know, honey, sometimes good comes out of some very bad things. Like when my father broke his leg when the tractor rolled over it, we had to sell all the cows, and it seemed like the worst thing that could have happened. But then a drought came along, and a lot of farmers had to sell their cows. By then, the price had gone way down. So you see, we were actually blessed by that broken leg. Elsa did not see what possible good could come out of failing to get into the MFA program. But then, Mom seemed so sure. Do you really need another degree to go on painting? No. Elsa knew she could go on teaching, and she did really enjoy the kids. Maybe she could even get married and have kids of her own. Outside in the switchyard, the engineers continued to assemble the train. As they added on each car, there was a long pause, and then the bump, 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 bang, as the other car slammed and locked it into place. Was another piece of her life being slammed into place? Elsa wondered. She reached over to the coffee table and began to unwrap the protective paper from around the chrysanthemum. This is Ebby Thompson for Mind's Eye Radio.
Writer John Morgan claims, "Ah, shucks, ma'am, he don't know so very much about railroadin'," and then remembers a couple of yarns, maybe that one story he heard from somewhere.
If you ask me what I know about trains, I would have to say not very much, but what little I know may have some interest, which is probably why I remember it. I know that shortly after the Transcontinental Railroad was completed, a congressional investigation of the railroad company's finances estimated that about half of the expenditure of government bonds to help finance the railroad was unaccounted for. It simply went down a rat hole. If a great accomplishment can be the byproduct of graft and corruption, then this was one of free enterprise's shining moments. It is also a fact that this same railroad wiped out several Native American cultures and nearly wiped out the buffalo. It couldn't have been built without killing off most of the buffalo, because they tore up the track every time a herd thundered across it. So if the Central Pacific and the Union Pacific Railroads had had to file an environmental impact statement, the Transcontinental Railroad would never have been built. I also know that the railroads first lost their dominance of commercial traffic during the 30s, when they lost a shooting war with the emerging trucking industry. The truckers simply outshot them. While this was not free enterprise's shining moment, it does show that the spirit of competition was alive and well in the land of the brave and the home of the well-armed. Of course, the railroads lost more ground after the completion of the interstate highway system. Not only did this country not know how to run a railroad, it really didn't care anymore. In the 19th century, working for the railroad was possibly the most dangerous job in the country. Thousands of workers lost their lives in the rail yards. When a friend recently told me that the average working life of a railroad worker in those days was 11 years, It put that sobering fact into sharper focus. On the lighter side, I also know a funny story about a train, which I recall from a biography of J.P. Morgan, no relation. As I remember the story, J.P. Morgan owned a railroad which ran along the back of his estate. Being a good Presbyterian, he sometimes had the minister over for dinner. One night after dinner, the minister looked at his watch and announced it was time for him to get down to the train station. J.P. told him to stay a while. They could flag the train down out behind his place. Well, they did that. The train came to a long, grinding halt. The two ran to catch up to it as the engineer climbed out and demanded to know what the trouble was. When informed, the engineer flew into a towering rage, turning the air blue, and told them that you do not stop a train in the middle of nowhere unless it's an emergency. But my good man, Morgan informed him, I own this railroad. This sent the engineer off into another tirade. I don't care how many railroads you own. You obviously don't know anything about railroads. I'll let your friend on this time, but if you ever pull that stunt again, I'll keep right on going. Morgan was chagrined. The captain of American Finance meekly replied, Sir, you're absolutely right. I give you my word that will never happen again. Another thing I know about railroads I learned from TV, that paragon of enlightenment. It seems that there is a bar in Southern California that sponsors an annual event, wherein about 100 patrons gather to get thoroughly drunk, then go out and line up along a chain-link fence to moon the Amtrak train as it passes by. That inspired this couplet, which I titled, You Saw It on TV. People who moon passenger trains expose what they're using for brains. This is John Morgan, no relation, for Mind's Eye Radio.
So all aboard for Pittsburgh, Dallas, Charleston, and Fort Wayne. Let's level all those cities, flush this old world down the drain. We'll cast off all the sorrow, strife, and pain. We can run like pagans laughing through the rain. Let's fish and hunt and gather wild grain. Then we'll raise a glass and share one last refrain. Of everybody who wants to ride, all aboard, let's take a ride. And everybody who wants to ride the train.
If I ever leave this chain gang, I am coming home once more. Mama, mama, do not scorn me, do not turn me from your door. Swing it high, boys, swing it low, boys, swing that hammer till you dead. Swing it high, boys, swing it low, boys, swing that hammer till you dead.
Even though derailment by buffalo is no longer a likely feature of one's journey by rail, some of the spirit of those days remains. Kathy Miner becomes a part of living history through the timeless medium of music.
We are on an adventure, my family and I, Chicago to Arizona on the Amtrak. It is the second day, and Robin and I have stayed awake all night in the dome car to watch the sunrise, but now it's overcast and no sun shows up. Somewhere in New Mexico, a man named Nando gets on board, a man with long black hair, loosely ponytailed, and a round, dark face. Turtle Clan Zuni, he says, by way of introduction. It seems we are crossing reservation land, and he will be our guide. Microphone in hand, he dispenses some short history and description, and then he takes out a cedar flute and begins to play, choosing me to hold the mic. From the first note, I know that I will hold it there until my arm falls off, should that prove to be necessary. Melody after melody he gives us. I look out the dirty window and watch the desert go by at 100 hazy miles an hour. Sweet music and dry, moving landscape forever paired in my mind. When he is finished and the applause has scattered, I tell him I too am a flutist, and silently he holds out his instrument to me. Knowing the depth of this offer, without a flicker of hesitation, I, who would counsel my adolescent sons never to do such a thing, take this object, which has been in a strange man's mouth, and put it directly in my own, and I find I am able to coax out sounds, though not so lovely as his. He hands me a business card, the name of the flute maker, an address in Albuquerque. At Gallup, he leaves us. I buy his tape on the station platform, $7, no tax added, cash on the table. Years later, I will see the same cassette at a powwow in Wisconsin. I tuck the flute maker's card inside the case, just in case. Though we have hours to travel to reach our destination, I am already there. The trip could end tomorrow, for I have found what I came for, and I am satisfied. Flute made by Paul Thompson of Albuquerque. Words and music made by Kathy Miner for Mind's Eye Radio.
Trains take us far and sometimes far back. In Paul Thompson's poem, Up Hoban's Hill, the sound of a train brings back a disturbing childhood memory.
We tried to break into the railroad shack. After that, Bobby Daniels and I lit two of his mother's camels and balanced our way down the track to the ruined barn on the Hoban place with the silver dollar driven into the beam. And swam up Hoban's Hill in a stream of goldenrod and Queen Anne's lace. The woods on the ridge were mosquito dim, solemn with maple, and violence of fungi in the hot silence attacking leaf fall and limb. A clearing. Jesus, I said. Flies serenaded the thing ahead, a huge black hog, swollen, dead, staring with blue-bottled eyes. A faint circulation of the air. Sweet stench tautened our fear. Then I thought I saw its ear twitch. I yelled, tore out of there, and ran headlong, mindlessly back as Bobby pantingly beseeched, "Wait up!" until we reached the safety of the sunlit track. Time has redrawn much of the town. I live in the Hoban subdivision. Bobby gave me a break on the commission. Last year, cancer brought him down. The late train rumbles the neighborhood, stirring my sleep. Then all falls still. I dream of children climbing a hill to disappear into a wood. This is Paul Thompson for Mind's Eye Radio.
running along to Asheville, blowing out its lonesome chimes for me. Makes me think of good old rambling days going by. Gee, it makes me lonely, can you see? Blow your whistle, freight train, carry on down the line. Blow your whistle, lady, you've got rambling on my mind. Hey, hey, lady, got a feeling that I want to ramble, and I know it will just be me. Guess I'll have to listen to that old smokestack singing out its lonesome chimes for me. Blow your whistle, freight train, carry on down the line. Blow got rambling on my mind. Hey, hey, lady, doodly, lady. Now I've got no home, no friends around me, riding that old freight train all the day. Gee, I am so lonesome, blue and sad. Wish I had a mother and a dad. Blow your whistle, freight train, carry me on down the line. Blow your whistle, lady, got rambling on my mind. Hey, hey, lady.
Madison poet Guy Thorvaldsen.
The rough and beaming lads lean on fence posts, bear witness to our sliding train. They wave and grin cannily as if they know us. Dutch, Germans, American travelers, who don't know, there is only futility in this tourist urge to unrhyme Scotland. A disoriented land all patched and smattered about, the tapestry of a truly wild creator. It is north of Stirling our primal nostrils flare, flood with blood scents, rich and decayed, until we instinctually rise from our seats, lift our chins like tongue-dragging dogs that seek the lair of their prey, our eyes glazed and brimming with the violet heather haze of chopped and distant hills. We open windows to the pelting rain, and the train thrusts on, pitching eastward, past a lone raven standing watch, a black mark on a green field, encircled by a stark and rolling bog, steadily chewed and eaten away by the stone-tumbling peat-brown river, falling, racing beneath the bridge. Farther north, sucked into wet and mossy tunnels, we disappear, dissipate, are left breathless, taken like stumbling lovers into the warm, silent dark of this rough-hewn land. Blindly we reach for what is known, groping damp cloth and skin, emerging in muted twilight, disheveled, shamed, as newborn lambs gambol beside the train. This is Guy Thorvaldsen for Mind's Eye Radio.
Swing it high, boys! Ah. Swing it!
Hope you got your ticket on time and didn't miss that last train. Love 'em, hate 'em, fear 'em, can't keep track of 'em, maybe miss 'em when they're gone. Trains are an enduring, and to some, an endearing part of our collective experience. And when they're gone, like peacetime, we're probably going to wish them back again. Till next month, this is Mind's Eye Radio, pulling out. Thanks for listening to Trains of Thought and Rail Tales from the Mind's Eye Radio Collective of Madison, Wisconsin. The show was produced by Kelly Warren and co-produced by Gay Davidson-Zilski. Contributing writers were Jeff Black, Esther Cameron, Kathy Miner, John Morgan, Norma Gay Pruitt, Fran Rall, Lynn Patrick Smith, Guyther Voltzen, Evie Thompson, and Paul Thompson. Original music by Barbara Chusid. If you'd like more information about Mind's Eye Radio, check out our website at mindseyeaudio.com. This is Greg Willard saying, all aboard for the peace train, and I mean that.